Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be back here once again, and I think we're going to hear, and I know we're going to hear quite a remarkable story, and I think we should just go right on into it. Take me back to that November day in 2008 when your life took a dramatic change.
Okay, well, I would start by explaining that in all those years as a neurosurgeon, I was quite certain I knew exactly how the brain gives rise to consciousness, mind, soul, and all that kind of thing. And I will tell you that the experience that I had in November of 2008 changed that completely. It all started about 4:30 in the morning when I woke up. I was working in Charlottesville at the time, but living in Lynchburg, so about an hour and 15-minute drive, and got out of bed and had severe back pain. And it just kind of struck me very suddenly, and I'd never had anything like that before. And it became much worse over the next several hours, and my wife Holly was trying to massage my back and make it better, and that wasn't working. My 10-year-old son Bond came into the room, saw that I was having a lot of pain, and he started rubbing my temples, which to me was like a white-hot spike going through the front of my head. I was too far gone to put it together even then. My wife went down to call my colleagues and find out what should I do. She came back upstairs, and I was having a grand mal seizure on the bed. I really remember nothing of any of that and then beyond. That was the last thing I remembered. It turns out I was taken off to the emergency room, and I was found to have a bacterial meningitis. I can tell you that having a rapid descent into coma with bacterial meningitis, when you hit the emergency room with that history, you already are down to about a 10% survival. So it's a very dangerous scenario. I had very good doctors. They were excellent. They jumped right on things and put me on triple IV antibiotics. To their surprise, the next day they found out that I had E. coli, and if you do a literature search on spontaneous E. coli meningitis in adults, you'll find out it's about a 1 in 10 million annual incidence, so it was really a big surprise, and of course that's just had the effect of helping me to focus on figuring out everything that happened to me. I went through the rest of that week with more and more dire predictions. I was not responding for about the first 5 days.
So you were totally unconscious.
I was on a ventilator, and you know, initially I was kind of combative, and I don't remember any of it, but I was still, some of my cortex was working, but then towards the end of the week, as they would lighten up the sedation, there wasn't anything going on there, and my eyes were very divergent, all due to damage to the brain stem. So it was well beyond a meningitis to an encephalitis. My scan showed diffuse damage of the cortex. So I was very sick, and then to their surprise, I started coming back. But to go into the experience itself, the meningitis was actually so effective at getting rid of the human part of my brain, the outer surface, that my recollections from within coma started out with absolutely no words, no memory of life on Earth, no memory of humans, no memory of family, no memory of anything of my life. All that was gone.
When you say, when did you start having those recollections?
Sometime inside coma. I can't really say much more than to say it happened inside the coma. And I know pretty clearly where the point is where I was starting to kind of wake up. But that was, in fact, when I first came out of all this, my older son, who was majoring in neuroscience, who could tell I was still pretty fragile, said, make sure you don't read anything or talk to anybody who was there until you've written everything down. If you'd asked me before my coma, how much does somebody with this kind of a medical story remember, I would have said, they don't remember a thing, not a single thing. And that would have been wrong. Because, in fact, I followed his advice, and as much as I wanted to read about near-death experiences, I didn't do it until my story was written. It took me about 6 weeks to write it all down, and it was more than 20,000 words. So it was a very rich, elaborate story, and of course we'll only have time to go into some of it here. But
well, let me take you back a little bit to the moment when you were starting to come out of the coma.
Mm-hmm.
It was, what, the sixth or seventh day?
Well, by then, so much had happened. I think it's best to really go down to what was going on deep inside and then lead up to what I remember on emergence. And I really kind of break it down into kind of three major domains that I remember. And the first one, kind of the earthworm eye view, seemed to go for a very, very long time. And if I had to put a number on it, I'd say I was there for months or years, possibly eternity. It really seemed to go on and on. Part of the problem was I had no prior existence. And another part of the problem is I'm quite convinced that memory, and you can bet I wrestled for several years with how in the world did memory record any of this, but I don't think memory was working at any kind of decent level deep inside. So it was this kind of foamy, bubbling, like mud, murk, like being in dirty jello underground, and just went on for a very long time with these kind of pounding, monotonous sounds. Absolutely non-responsive. I had no words. But from that, I was rescued by this beautiful melody, a spinning melody of light. And I have no idea where that originally came from, but to me it was most interesting, as I tried to write all this up later, how it seemed to come at a time when I was deep, deep inside of that earthworm eye view and that murky, muddy realm. And
when you talk about a melody of light, are you referring to music?
Yeah, there was an absolutely beautiful, it was both. It was so much of this recollection involved no body. I had no body memory or awareness during any part of the part in coma. And so the memories were very, they're in some ways hard to describe, although I try to do that, but often sound and sight and kind of smell and feel and all that was intermixed. And I would try to remember certain parts of it, say, as visual, but I'd be getting a lot of auditory. But it was a melody that was a spinning light, and it was an absolutely beautiful melody, very rich and harmonious, in contradistinction to that pounding kind of bass line that had been there for such a long time in the earthworm eye view. And that led up into this brilliant green valley, waterfalls, crystal pools, and on a butterfly wing with millions of other butterflies and flying through these blossoming flowers and blooms and absolutely indescribably rich, real beauty with these arcs of light up above. In my writings, I said these were angels. There were these hymns, these chants, these choruses coming down. And any question in my mind about what this was, again, I had no words at all at that point, but pure conceptual flow. And the any kind of curiosity or wonder about this was answered with these resounding, awesome, powerful anthems coming from above, and then this sense of a warm breeze that was this most comforting sense of the divine. And beside me on the wing of this butterfly was this beautiful girl, and I could remember her face perfectly. So comforting, never said a word, pure thoughts coming in. You are loved, you are cherished, you will never be thrown away. There's nothing you can do wrong. You are infinitely loved forever. And it was the most comforting thing after what I had been through. And from that point, it was outside of this entire universe. The whole thing collapsing down, not just what we consider universe, but higher dimensional and space and time and everything collapsing down. And then being taught these lessons by this orb of light and by that divine, absolutely loving, indescribable, unconditionally loving source of it all.
So a euphoric experience, an experience that it sounds like you might not want to have come back from.
I would say it was absolute. It was euphoria. I thought I felt euphoria before at certain times in my life, and euphoria really does not do it justice. This, you're right on the beam, though. It was absolutely indescribably wonderful in every sense of the word.
So what happened after that then?
Well,
The
concept when I would go out there was that there are many things we will show you, and you'll be going back. And I had no idea what that meant, but and they would show me lots of lessons about love and about evil and about the physical makeup of time and space and how this time is completely illusory, what we see as time flow here. So many lessons. And then I would find myself back in the earthworm eye view. And it was a real mystery, that transition. So many people have asked me, well, how did that happen? Did you, you know, kind of fall back through it all or whatever? And it was never like that. It was always like, it was almost as if that were a lesson that had to do with kind of the vagaries and the illusory nature of what we consider time flow and sequencing. But I would end up in the earthworm eye view, but the thing that was, I remember discovering that by remembering the notes of the melody, and it took me a long time back in the earthworm eye view, but the notes of the melody, by remembering them and kind of putting them in order in my mind, the melody would come back and spin this beautiful light and then back up on the butterfly wing and then back out through the gateway and back out to the core. And I know that I did that at least three more times where I used that memory to go back. And I was always told, you're not here to stay.
And but when you say you were told and you referred to they giving you lessons, who were the they?
It was conceptual flow. It had nothing to do with words, but the concept flow there was astonishing. There's no limitation of linear kind of thinking, rational thought, linguistic. The concepts were so pure and complete. And it was a very, very strong sense of being there with that divine, loving, creative source that was through everything of the, you know, not only the higher dimensional multiverse and all of eternity, but beyond all that as the creative source of it, and an orb of light, and a very distinct awareness that they're really the three. So there was awareness, consciousness, but it was far beyond the consciousness of any one individual. I mean, this was all of consciousness. But also this orb that was this brilliant light. Initially, when I entered that area, which I call the core, it was blacker than coal and infinitely, you know, in time, space, and higher dimensions, infinite, to the point where this kind of extremely complex corrugated what appeared to be kind of an oversphere, which was all of the compacted higher dimensional space and time and eternity, given the fact that that was a manageable piece of all this, can give you kind of a flavor of what infinity might encompass and what the feeling of it might be.
So to follow up on your story then, to go back to that sixth day or the seventh day when you started, when from the perspective of the people in the hospital watching you, started to wake up to become conscious again, what was happening then?
That was actually after as I said, I recall three times where I was able to use the melody, and, you know, counting is very different. Sequencing, time, all of that is so different in that realm. It's hard to put it into words. But I found that the melody no longer worked. And it was at that point that I was aware of thousands of people in arcs around me kind of kneeling and all kind of, you know, I had no idea who any of them were or anything, but all kneeling around and going off into the darkness and all this murmuring coming up from them. And I was kind of billowing up on these clouds, and it was absolutely gorgeous and loving, because I remember extreme sadness knowing the melody no longer would take me out there. And yet I was being billowed up with this wonderful, and my interpretation as I was writing this up is that these were prayers of people getting in, and this was a welcoming back. And of course I still had no idea what back was going to be, but it was very comforting at a time when I could no longer get to that you know, the gateway, the beautiful valley, the butterfly, and the core.
That was comforting. So you
it was
did
very
not,
comforting.
Because we've
the
heard
prayers.
Stories about how yeah. some people didn't want to come
No,
back.
The prayers were very comforting. And I think there's a huge lesson there. And certainly when I talk to physicians and nurses, as I make a very big point about that, and even if you've got a brain-dead patient or whatever, you know, don't think you understand what their level of awareness is. And, you know, even after bodily death, it's very clear to me that that in fact our awareness and consciousness is actually liberated to a much grander state than here we're kind of dumbed down. And there are reasons for that. I mean, I say we're conscious in spite of our brain. And, of course, to our traditional neuroscientific model, that's like, well, wait a minute, what did you just say? And yet it actually makes a tremendous amount of sense when you have seen what it's like to be outside of space and time and have that kind of information flow. I mean, if we were flooded with that here all the time fully, we wouldn't do a very good job surviving as a mammal, you know, competing for resources in this little dumbed down realm.
Now, before this experience, were you familiar with the near-death experience literature?
I knew it existed. I'd never really read it or paid attention to it. I had grown up in a religious home. My father was a neurosurgeon. He was very spiritual. He'd been a combat surgeon in the Pacific World War II, and his spirituality had gotten him through all that. So I grew up in that kind of spiritual environment. But in my scientific career, as the years went on, I just increasingly had difficulty seeing how in the world there could be a soul or consciousness that existed after bodily death. And I think, like a lot of physicians and nurses, I saw a lot of examples, you know, in people passing over and in patients' families who would call me months later after they'd lost a loved one about this experience they'd had that showed them that spirit was there contacting them. And we all have those things, but we don't know how to file them away if we're stuck in that kind of physicalist model. So I had no idea how to file it.
So you're saying that before this experience, you would have assumed that it all ended once you
right.
died.
Exactly.
And would it be fair to describe your orientation as materialist?
Yes. I mean, I believed hook, line, and sinker that if you know physics, chemistry, biology, neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, then at some point we should be able to then start talking about how consciousness emerges. And yet I can tell you now that, in fact, I think there are very solid reasons why we will actually never be able to connect the dots going in that direction. But it all makes infinitely more sense coming down from the other side.
So when you regained consciousness, full consciousness, this whole experience was present for you? I guess I'm wondering, at what point does it become a memory of sort of trying to recall what it was and how at what point was it there and real?
When I first started coming back in the ICU, it was a Sunday morning. It was the seventh day of my coma. And I remembered seeing faces. And this was, as far as I recall, it was very soon after billowing up on the clouds with all the thousands of people in arcs around me. With what I later said were prayers and the beautiful comfort and love of all that. And faces would appear in my awareness. Again, I was kind of back to that earthworm eye view again, the bubbling mud. And a face would come out of it and it would say these words. It was kind of like Charlie Brown's Christmas where the adult's talking, it's wah, 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 wah. Because I still didn't have understanding of any language. But I was very rapidly coming out, and there were six faces. And in the next few hours, as I continued to wake up, I knew who the six were. One of them had not physically been there. She was a friend of my wife, Susan Wrenches. She wrote a book called Third Eye Open. She had done some kind of channeling work with coma patients, something I never understood before. But she had come to me several times, not physically, but from her home in Chapel Hill, and I was distinctly aware of her face and then five other faces of people there, one of whom, because in this whole experience I had felt no fear, and most of that was based on the fact that I thought nothing mattered, that I could exist or not exist, didn't matter. And then I saw one face that really frightened me tremendously. It was my 10-year-old son. I didn't recognize him. I didn't know who this was. But there was something about this 10-year-old, and it was that Sunday morning, and they'd protected him most of the week from the bad news. But he had heard that morning a discussion about potentially stopping antibiotics and everything. And he was in there kind of rubbing me and pleading, Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay. And, you know, prying my eyes open, Daddy, you're going to be okay. And all of a sudden, from inside, it was the most frightening part of the whole journey, because all of a sudden I realized I wasn't the only one existing.
It wasn't just about you.
It wasn't anyway. Just about me. And that, I cannot tell you how terrifying that was, because I didn't realize until that time, you know, I knew I had almost no control over any of this, that other than the spinning melody, which had taken me back into this beautiful realm, this hyper-real, ultra-rich realm, I really didn't understand anything about where I was, and I had no control over it. And now this other soul was pleading with me to do okay. And at some level, it really, it definitely got my attention in just a huge way. And so I started struggling my way back up into consciousness. And then over the next few hours, my language was starting to come back. I did go on to have 24 very rocky hours of what in retrospect was a psychotic, paranoid nightmare. And initially, as I was telling my physicians about all these incredible things that had happened, they would say, "Oh, yes, you were very sick. Your brain was soaking in pus, and we had you on fentanyl and Haldol and Ativan and all these things. And, you know, no wonder you had such weird experiences." And, of course, they had no idea how I was even coming back. I
mean, they had assumed you were going to die, right?
What they were trying to do, and the physicians in the room will get this, is to avoid that trap of rescuing somebody from the jaws of death and preserving a vegetable. So they were getting ready to discuss, you know, just stopping the antibiotics and letting nature take its course. They had no idea where this was coming from. I mean, I really should not be coming back. I mean, even if I lived through it, which, of course, was kind of their worst nightmare, I shouldn't have been coming back and talking about all this. But they said, "You were very sick." And so initially I just lumped it all together and said, well, crazy, delusional, paranoid nightmare, and, you know, earthworm my view, and this beautiful gateway, and this incredible outside of the universe where I would go back and forth many times. And I just thought, somehow I've got to explain this in a neuroscientific fashion. So that was my original goal, write this up as a neuroscientific report.
You said that when you first came back to consciousness, your son advised you to, you know, don't read the literature, get the story out yourself.
Right.
And you have a narrative now. You have a way to tell the story. Did it take you a while to construct that narrative?
Yeah, as I said, it took me 6 weeks to write the story down of everything I remembered from within coma. And that was a little over 20,000 words. But, of course, then the real challenge began. Because then I had to try and make sense of it. And I went through 9 different neuroscientific hypotheses that might explain the hyperreality, might explain some of what I remembered based on meningitis and based on neuroanatomy, neurophysiology. Turns out it's very fortunate I had meningitis, just because it is so efficient, especially a severe case. I mean, my CSF glucose, which was normally 60 to 80. In a bad case of bacterial meningitis, might go down to 20. My CSF glucose was 1. My cell count was 4,500. I was extremely ill with this and should not have come back. But it's also very handy because several of the models I had, if I'd been in coma for any other reason, from head trauma or subarachnoid hemorrhage or something, you could postulate that some of the cortex was still working. And the cortex is the only calculator in the brain that physically can handle the calculations that would give you this extremely rich, exuberant, interactive, kind of intermeshed auditory, visual, experiential extravaganza, which is what I had. And yet my cortex was off. And so...
So you're saying there's no, in the conventional scientific framework, there's no way you should have had this experience because your cortex was not functioning.
Took me about a year to get to that realization, but yes, there was no way it could happen in my brain.
I mean, part of what's fascinating about your story, I mean, aside from just the level of detail that you were telling us, is you're a neurosurgeon. I mean, you know how the brain works.
Well, and if this had happened to any of my patients before my coma, I would have patted them on the back. "You were very sick." it is kind of an amazing set of circumstances, and it has forced me to realize, of course, I can tell you, as a neurosurgeon, I've learned a tremendous amount about consciousness that I never had to know as a kind of a streetwise neurosurgeon, even in an academic medical center. There's a lot that I had to learn, and it has to do with philosophy of mind and with quantum mechanics and with what's called the hard problem of consciousness, which is really kind of at the core of a lot of this. And to me, it became very clear that consciousness is the thing that exists. And in fact, I've done a lot of work in meditation and in deep exploration of consciousness, now serving as research director for the Monroe Institute. And I've done more than a year fairly steady meditation with their techniques. The realization is that consciousness is everything that Pim Ben Lomel says and more. It's, you know, it's non-local. It's really the thing that exists. And modern physics has been trying to tell us in so many words that what we look around and see as physical reality is in so many ways illusory.
Why are you so convinced about that? I mean, there are other neuroscientists out there who study near-death experiences. They say it's all brain chemistry.
I'm certain it's not all brain chemistry.
Why are you certain?
Well, for one thing, my experience was a good starting point because it really, to me, it was a very strong argument that consciousness, and in fact, I can tell you that a much richer consciousness exists when we are free from the shackles of physical human brain and mind. And, you know, if it were just my experience and that's all I had to go on, I'd be stuck. The fact of the matter is that we have thousands of reported, and I can tell you many tens of millions of near-death experiences and other mystical experiences, the shared death experiences that Ray Moody has recently brought to light in such a beautiful way. And the good news for everybody, you don't have to almost die to get there. Okay? The great news is these answers, this realm, is within all of us. And through various meditative techniques, I think Dr. Groff has been a wonderful pioneer at helping people to get to these levels, and certainly Bob Monroe and the Monroe Institute in Hemisync, meditation, transcendental meditation, centering prayer.
Are you saying with those kinds of techniques, meditation, centering prayer, you can have that same kind of experience, the intensity of the experience described?
I'm saying that you can go to the same realms and start having access to a lot of the same kind of wisdom. A big part of this is letting go of self. The linguistic brain that obviously I kind of honored is, you know, I think my parents kind of honored because they put a lot of, you know, effort into my tuition for me to go through all that schooling, you know, and I put that up on such a pedestal. And in fact, it's the first thing, I liken it now to a teenager that needs to go into timeout. You know, that little linguistic brain and the closely associated ego. I mean, the ego is absolutely against every bit of this kind of knowing. And those things have to be set aside. And you can go take courses, listen to lectures, watch the DVDs, etc., and they can steer you in the right path. But that's not where the real wisdom comes from. It comes from within, and it's within all of us. Every owner of consciousness has this inside of them. But you really have to do the work and get there. But every bit of what I went through in my experience is available. That kind of wisdom, that kind of guidance exists. And I'm convinced that the reductive scientific, you know, neuroscientific approach to taking physical reality of the brain and everything we know and then coming up to explain consciousness is doomed to failure.
Now, obviously, this was a life-changing experience. I mean, no question about that. Are you a different person now?
My family says I'm better. And I'm not sure what to say about that. They're obviously pretty grateful to have me back.
Can you be as specific as you can about that?
Yeah,
how
I can tell you. Yeah. I can tell you that yes, it's totally changed me in many, many ways. But probably the most fundamental way is when I sit around in a room like this, what I see are individual souls that are spending time in these costumes for this act of the play. And I know that, you know, they're cooperating with other souls. I kind of look at that as flying fish, and we're kind of in and out together, schools of flying fish, and we're helping each other, the souls. And a manifestation of one of my soulmates might appear as an enemy or my nemesis in this existence, and yet they may still be there helping me to learn a very crucial lesson. The hardships, the difficulties, the hurdles are all gifts. And seeing that reality in a very beautiful way and seeing more about what each and every soul is up to, and I firmly believe that, in fact, the entire reason for existence of this universe has to do with our souls manifesting free will, serving as a conduit of that unconditional love. And those words do not begin to show the light of what that really means, but people can find that out in deep meditation, centering prayer. They can get in touch with the extreme power, infinite power, of that unconditional love, and that it's manifesting that in this down and dirty realm of physical reality, very imperfect, very kind of slow, time-limited, bottleneck, and yet our souls are chomping at the bit to get down in here.
So at on a day-to-day level, what's different? I mean, do things not bug you as much as they used to?
I love that quote from that Penny showed. If everybody could have an NDE, you can just throw wars, violence, greed, starvation, just chuck them out the window. They would never, ever happen. And yet we don't need NDEs. We can all get there. All get there through meditation, centering prayer. Gift of desperation is often what opens the door. I know that from many years of experience with patients facing malignant brain tumors, things like that.
But what do your fellow doctors say about your experience when you've talked to them about it?
I would say that the neurosurgeons, if I have about 10 minutes, they see it. And then they start to realize, yeah, of course, this makes sense. They do need a little bit of time. And it really kind of hinges on quantum mechanics and the hard problem of consciousness. But
most neurosurgeons don't know anything.
They don't know
about
that. So they need a little bit of a kind of a crash course. But like I said, given 10 minutes.
So you're saying, that's interesting. You're saying then for trained medical professionals, for scientists, they need a theoretical model to try to make sense of this. Without that, they're going to write this off.
For me, it's all a question of coming to truth. And coming to truth means putting together everything that I know I can believe exists and is real, all the relationships, and putting it into a sensible model. And they're willing to do that. And they know, so many physicians have seen, and nurses have seen, patients making the transition. I've got a little anecdote I tell in my book about this wonderful friend who's head of one of the premier neuroscience groups on Earth. And I was visiting with him December a year ago, and he was telling me, he was looking at me kind of shocked as I told my story, because... And then he told me about an experience he'd had with his father passing over about 8 months earlier. And it was absolutely stunning. It was clear to him his father was seeing his own mother, that would have been my friend's grandmother, 65 years earlier, who had come to welcome him into the next realm. And he had no doubt at all. It was not a hallucination. There was every bit of evidence, very powerful, that told him this was totally real. But he had no idea how to explain it. And so many doctors and nurses have seen that. And families have seen that. And, in fact, after every talk I give, I'll have two or three people come up, well, I've never told anybody this, but... And I think what Dr. Moody has pointed out here, which I think is just beautiful, is this whole phenomenon of the of the shared death experience, because those are not brains that are physiologically compromised. And the same is true about meditation, centering prayer. The reason is that consciousness is the thing that exists. And I think at its very core, there is one consciousness. And for me, I have a pretty clear view of what my, how that all fit together deep inside of my experience and becoming one. And it's really just seeing that the kind of that divine spark is in each and every one of us. It's what we call consciousness. But it's very easy for me to see how the brain is a reducing valve, and it's actively limiting our access to that knowing. And also, of course, consciousness entails this these illusions of space and time that are very much illusions. And physics is getting to telling us that anyway. They're kind of on the verge of saying with quantum mechanics that locality is an absolute illusion. And not only that, when you look a little deeper, that time is very much part of consciousness, but not a primary part underlying reality. And when I say that, I have to say kind of going to a level that is the fundament of what we call physical reality, which the physicists will tell you doesn't exist anyway.
So given your experience, given all that you've, the way you've thought about this, what advice would you have to other doctors, to people in the medical profession who might be dealing with people near death?
I think my advice really to so many, and it would certainly include the doctors and the nurses, is that every bit of this existence has to do with the power of that love at the core of it all. And you can bet I struggled long and hard trying to write up my neuroscientific explanation. Now, how am I going to put this in there about how unconditional love energizes everything that's going on?
There's what does that mean, though, in terms of actual care? I mean, for people who work in a hospital, for instance.
That all of this is about healing. Healing self, healing others. I mean, you talk to the remote viewing program, you know, the Stargate psychic spy program in the U.S. military, which had very tight links with Monroe and what they were doing. There was no way they could do any of that with kind of a malicious intent. It had to be several layers removed from, you know, war with the Soviets. It all had to be based at some deep level. The energy that was driving that and that drives these phenomena of what I call extended consciousness. I don't like, you know, psi and parapsych and all that, because in fact it's reality that's there is our consciousness, which is non-local and involves all of these potentials. I think this is all going towards global and then kind of a cosmic telepathy that has to do with our one consciousness. And people, obviously, the capability is there. It's been shown. Any of the scientists in the crowd who have a doubt, I would refer them to Irreducible Mind, that wonderful book from Esalen, but also via the Division of Perceptual Studies. Bruce Grace and Ed Kelly, Emily Kelly at University of Virginia, came out 4 years ago. Irreducible Mind is 800 pages of solid, powerful, overwhelming evidence that mind is far, far more than what the physicalist model says. And that is very real. And in fact, what I'd like to do is really kind of take this to the medical world in a big way, because I think by helping the medical world to grow up to this, for one thing, it will enhance their ability as healers. But for another thing, it'll take the lid off the top of what humans go through by the millions every day.
I want to go to the audience in just a minute here, but one last question before I do that. Do you still practice medicine?
Well, I am seeing patients now, and it turns out that I'm kind of old school, which means if you operate on people, you got to be there for them 24/7. You can imagine after I figured out what this experience was telling me, I knew I had to get it out there. And in fact, I even had to take almost a year away from any kind of practice to write the book and to give some presentations and to kind of get out there. But I have started seeing patients again, but I'm not operating on them.
And we should mention that you are writing about this experience, and the
right.
book is
there is a
scheduled
book.
To come out early next
yeah,
year.
Yeah, the book, Simon & Schuster, will be publishing it in the U.S., and there are actually agreements, I think, in 9 or 10 other countries based on the proposal to publish it elsewhere, too. So it'll be coming out in many countries around the world around early next year. I would like to get it out in December. I think there are some messages that I have that are kind of related to all the hoopla around December 21st, 2012. But anyway, we will get it out as soon as we can. I have to finish the book, which will be done by June 1st. And then I think hopefully it's being written for the general public. It's not, I'll mention a little bit about the quantum mechanics and the hard problem of consciousness, but only enough so they realize what this all really means. And it also has to do with a 4,000-year arc of human kind of history around the world that is now kind of converging on where we should be.
That's all.
It's a reconciliation of science and spirituality.
Well, we should go to the audience here. We have 5 to 10 minutes or so. There's a roving microphone. Yeah, let's go to Dr. Moody.
I would like to know, did you ever find out anything about the young woman you saw in your vision?
You want the punchline. Okay. Yes. I did. And in fact, that was a tremendous part of actually understanding what this all meant, because I can tell you that, you know, I wrote my whole story out, and then I started reading about near-death experiences, and I was, initially I was kind of blown away because I realized, well, millions of people have been where I went, and I came to realize that all kinds of mystical states, prophets, religious scholars over millennia had been to the same place. Everybody was talking about the same thing. Of course, there's some filtering mechanism that has to do with when we come back and try and tell our fellow humans about it, that give it kind of these cultural and religious overtones. But in fact, deep inside, we're all going to the same place and having a very similar experience. But I was haunted as I read more and more of the literature, because if there was one soul I wanted to encounter, it was my father, who had passed over 4 years before my coma. And he was not there. He was nowhere to be seen. And this beautiful guardian angel on the butterfly wing, she was there every time I went back in, the most comforting, beautiful presence she had, these thoughts coming into my mind. But I didn't know who she was. I remembered her face so clearly that I knew I'd never in my life before coma met her. And that to me was a real, to me they were potentially real game breakers, you know, that I had no idea why I had that lack in my experience compared to all the other NDEs. And it was about 4 months after my coma, and to kind of complete even this thumbnail sketch of what happened, I have to give a little background. I was adopted. I was put up for adoption when I was 2 weeks old. And I looked for my birth mother and did not find her over years, and I'd given